Too many people in America fear their government, and the government is being run by too many powerful agencies like the IRS and others. I think it's time that people take the country back through their representative government.
You are listening to an American Free Press podcast. The complete reading of American Free Press weekly newspaper, number 42, October 18th, 2010. Trillions in debt. Will real cost of TARP soar into quadrillions? By Christopher J. Petherick. The Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP, ended in September. Since then, Washington has been trying to prove that bailing out Wall Street with taxpayer money prevented the total collapse of the economy. While taxpayers are expected to get back much of their money, TARP is only a small part of the trillions of dollars worth of backdoor bailouts, asset guarantees, low-interest loans, free money, and other benefits handed out to the money trust. But thanks to secrecy on the part of the banksters, Americans may never know just how much money the economic depression of 2007 actually cost them. TARP was passed in October 2008. At the time, the massive $700 billion handout to Wall Street was the largest taxpayer-funded bailout of all time. Today, Washington's economists contend that taxpayers should get most of that money back, except for about 50 to 60 billion. But in reality, this is only the tip of the iceberg. According to Bloomberg News reporters Mark Pittman and Bob Ivory, when all the special deals are tallied, the true costs come in at around $12.8 trillion, $1 trillion short of the U.S. gross domestic product. This includes $29 billion worth of tax breaks for banks, $168 billion given by the Bush administration as part of a smaller stimulus program, $787 billion handed out by President Obama under his stimulus package, $400 billion for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to prop up the mortgage industry, $500 billion released by the FDIC to cover bank failures, plus $300 billion from the Federal Housing Authority to help the troubled housing sector. But this is not all that was offered to financial firms. There are trillions more dollars that the privately owned and controlled Federal Reserve has handed out to keep the system afloat. Over the past 2 years, the Fed has created numerous financial programs which function solely to guarantee risky loans and complicated debt and interest rate swaps and to back assets that continue to lose their value. Fed bankers also lowered the discount rate to near zero, handing out free money for bankers to use at their own discretion. They were even making hundreds of billions of dollars worth of loans to foreign central banks. Of course, the Federal Reserve did not want the soiled masses to know any of this. The Fed arrogantly continues to stonewall the release of all the details to the public, so there may be billions or even trillions of dollars more that we don't know about. Page 2. Personal from the editor. Web of lies. You can almost smell where this is headed. An exotic computer virus that can disable or destroy utility systems, intelligence officers embedding with news organizations, various agencies involved in surveillance through internet-based social media, and fusion centers that pool data for local, state, and national police, who are given reports that brand concerned Americans as would-be terrorists. This indicates tough times ahead. The internet, or the net, as we call it for short, could be controlled and construed as a net that snares us instead of an interactive network that helps free us. Unless we get informed, inform many others, and shine a continual light on these activities, we need to watch for false flag internet incidents that could trick us into internet controls and censorship, thereby canceling the freedom of information that we need. I invite everyone reading this to call their local sheriff, talk to former police officers who believe in liberty, former military people, etc. In doing so, call attention to things such as fusion centers in your home state. Keeping these issues public is critical to avoid a wall of secrecy behind which dark ideas can take root. The people of the United States, a bankrupt nation, have to repudiate all unjust national and state debts and keep focused on outlawing the centralized, privately run banking system that lurks behind this police state schematic. The banksters are armed with weapons called perpetual interest and endless borrowing at the personal and public levels. Without their treachery, little or none of this Big Brother stuff would be happening. We're venturing into some different stories this week, even while we never let up on the key ongoing issues, the banking cartel, 9/11, Zionism, etc. Quick update. The Westboro Baptists, profiled in last week's edition, went before the Supreme Court in a major and controversial free speech case. Stay tuned. This week, like last week, we're trying something different with our front page, formatting the featured story to fit on an 8.5 by 11 sheet. Please take the article to a nearby print shop and photocopy it. Hand out as many copies as you can. Our contact information is listed at the end of the article. We'll let you know the results, and we want your feedback. Would you like to see this front page design more often? Do you think it's better for outreach? Send comments to me, Editor Mark Anderson, 645 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast, number 100, Washington, D.C., 20003. Mark Anderson. News you may have missed. 9/11, 25,000 years of experience speaks. Because of the popular CSI, crime scene investigation, TV programs, American juries demand scientific evidence examined by experts. The CSI 9/11 forensic expert witnesses have spoken. More than 1,000 architects and engineers, with more than 25,000 years of collective experience, have spoken. The government's official conspiracy theory is bunkum. Check out ae911truth.org/911investigator and see the evidence for yourself. When banks rob, Bank of America is now swept up in the $11 trillion mortgage scandal, along with J.P. Morgan Chase, Ally Financial, GMAC, and other lenders caught using robo-signers and committing possible fraud with their rubber stamp modus operandi of evicting families. A vice president for bankruptcy and foreclosure for One West testified her team of seven signed off on evicting 24,000 families each month, taking about 30 seconds to examine each foreclosure. Tourist Welcome Center. Mexican drug cartel pirates gunned down an American tourist while his wife watched in horror. Dodging bullets, she managed to race their boat back to the American side of Falcon Lake. This was the fifth attack on the border lake just south of Laredo, Texas, this year. Medical monsters. While Americans were fighting for FDR's four freedoms, medical doctors were conducting horrific experiments on unaware, unwilling racial inferiors. Hundreds of men, women, children, and soldiers in Guatemala were deliberately infected with syphilis and other terrible diseases. After scores died, they decided the experiment was too much trouble, so they abandoned the surviving victims. Terrible Nazis? No. These studies were funded by the U.S. taxpayers via the U.S. Public Health Service, National Institutes of Health, and what is now the World Health Organization's Pan-American Health Organization. Scourge of the South. Atlanta has come up with an inexpensive, novel way to fight kudzu, the invasive vine known as the Scourge of the South. Officials have brought in a herd of 24 goats to fight the fast-growing plant in one park where it has gotten so bad the city can't keep up with it. With each goat eating up to 200 square feet of kudzu a day, they're expected to have the entire park cleaned up in less than a month. Ford revved up. Toronto mayoralty candidate Rob Ford, outspoken and politically incorrect, is close to becoming the mayor. He's doing such a good job that what some call the Illuminati Toronto Star published an op-ed piece asking that the other mayoral candidates, save for favored boy George Slitherman, drop out and allow Slitherman a better chance to defeat Ford. Goldilocks planet found in constellation of Libra. For the first time, scientists have found a planet in the Goldilocks zone of an extrasolar star system. The zone is neither too cold nor too hot to possibly support life as we know it. Officially known by the unglamorous name of Gliese 581G, the planet was discovered by the Lick Carnegie Exoplanet Survey. It is known that the planet, which has been called Zarmina by its discoverer, is solid like the Earth, although it appears to be larger than Earth. It is the sixth planet found so far orbiting the red dwarf star Gliese 581 in the constellation of Libra, just 20 light-years away, a mere skip and jump by galactic standards. Page 3. AFP on cyber warfare. Was Israeli virus behind disaster in Southern California? By Ralph Forbes. No country is more vulnerable to cyber attack than the United States, according to national intelligence estimates. Our electric grids are all run using computers, and cyber warfare experts say our national electric system is vulnerable to attack. A click of a button and the whole country goes black. Everything stops, frozen food goes bad, water isn't pumped. Electricity is needed to run pumps at gas stations. Worse than a blackout, certain malware, computer viruses and worms, could cause any nuclear power plant anywhere to malfunction disastrously, like Chernobyl, or worse. This is not science fiction. Israel, one of the major cybercrime centers that creates and unleashes viruses, is the likely source of Stuxnet, a virus designed to attack the Siemens computers that run Iran's Bushehr nuclear power plant. This facility was actually started 30 years ago at the behest of the United States. The Stuxnet worm, known as the malware of the century, was created to destroy Iran's nuclear facilities. Susan Wilson on the technology website tech.blorge.com wrote, "The worm can attack control systems for a variety of industries, from gas and electric to nuclear computer systems. But it isn't the Stuxnet worm that has people so worried. It's the next generation worm that Stuxnet copycats could create. Stuxnet was let loose in Iran to sabotage its new power plant. The worm is the equivalent of scattering tens of thousands of digital cluster bombs that explode randomly. Stuxnet escaped Iran's borders and now runs amok over the entire World Wide Web, sniffing inside every online computer, including yours, searching for Siemens industrial control computers to attack. These controllers are widely used to manage oil pipelines, drilling platforms, electrical power grids, nuclear plants, chemical plants, and many other industrial applications in the United States and worldwide. Sabotaging the computer systems designed to control Iran's huge nuclear power plant has long been a high priority of cybercrats in both the United States and Israel. They have poured huge resources, courtesy of the U.S. taxpayer, into Unit 8200, Israel's secretive cyber warfare operation. U.S. cyber war operations are hidden inside the National Security Agency and the Pentagon's new Cyber Command. Stuxnet is the malware of the century because of its ability to damage or destroy critical control systems. The really scary part is that Stuxnet is a cyber weapon able to determine what physical process it wants to blow up, says Joe Weiss, industrial control specialist at Applied Control Systems in Cupertino, California. Stuxnet opened Pandora's box, warned German researcher Ralph Langer. He is very concerned about the threat from this cyber war weapon's next generation. The name of a key file inside the virus is Mertis, which means Esther, the Hidden One, or Ishtar. Esther is the name of an Old Testament book which doesn't mention God even once. It is a tale of ancient Jews committing genocide, murdering 75,000 innocent Persians, the ancestors of today's Iranians. This slaughter is still celebrated by Jews in Israel and worldwide with drunken orgies during the Feast of Purim. Not surprisingly, Israeli intelligence, motto, "We shall wage war by deception," will neither confirm nor deny that Stuxnet is a weapon created by Unit 8200. Iran may have been the primary target, but the malicious code has already spread beyond 30,000 computers in Iran to at least 15,000 critical computers in many other countries, including China, India, and Indonesia. Computer control failures played a role in the explosion of British Petroleum's Deepwater Horizon oil platform, killing 11, injuring 17 others, and spilling millions of tons of crude into the Gulf of Mexico. The cause of the tremendous deadly explosion that devastated an entire neighborhood in San Bruno, California on September 9th is still a mystery, but it could have been caused by a malfunctioning control system in a gas pipeline. It is the type of disaster that could strike any of the many control mechanisms in the 2.365 million miles of hazardous liquid and gas pipelines in the United States. The Gulf disaster and the San Bruno event are just two examples of the kind of havoc that Stuxnet or other malware like it can create. Will a cyber war, fueled in part by the push to attack Iran, come back to bite us? Has it already begun? Page 4. AFP on Big Brother. Latest in a series. Facebook does things CIA could only dream of. Who needs spies When You Have a Half Billion People Revealing Their Most Intimate Secrets Online, by Ralph Forbes. Longtime American Free Press readers may recall that DARPA, Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, has some creepy tentacles. The Information Awareness Office, IAO, Total Information Awareness, TIA, renamed Terrorism Information Program, and TIPS, Terrorism Information and Prevention System. By 2003, an irate American people forced the government to drop these spooky command and control police state operations. Or did they? The vampire coven was seemingly dead and buried, but was the stake actually driven through its evil heart? In 2002, Divya Narendra had an idea for a social network site. By the fall of 2003, she and twin brothers Cameron and Tyler Winklevoss were looking for a web developer who could bring their idea to life. On November 30th, 2003, they hired Mark Zuckerberg to finish their program's codes. Little did they know what a monster Zuckerberg would hatch. Zuckerberg bragged about taking his clients' money so he could take their idea to make his own website, which became Facebook. He pretended to work on their project so he could stall and sabotage it. He also boasted he was backed by the Brazilian mafia, but as AFP's revelations will show, it is dangerous to believe anything Zuckerberg says. Notably, The Social Network is a new movie based on Zuckerberg and the pre-CIA founding years of Facebook, starring Jesse Eisenberg as Zuckerberg. Check upcoming issues of AFP to see how closely the script depicts the shocking facts. But as bad as the beginning of Facebook is, parallels between the CIA's backing of Google's dream of becoming the mind of God and the CIA's funding of Facebook's goal of knowing everything about everybody are spookier. Congress stopped the Information Awareness Office from gathering as much information as possible about everyone in a centralized nexus for easy spying by the U.S. government, including internet activity, credit card purchase histories, airline ticket purchases, car rentals, medical records, educational transcripts, driver's licenses, utility bills, tax returns, and all other available data. The government's plan was to emulate communist East Germany's Stasi police state by getting mailmen, Boy Scouts, teachers, students, and others to spy on everyone else. Children would be urged to spy on parents. Facebook, however, does what no dictator ever dreamed of. It has a half billion people willingly doing a form of spy work on all their friends, family, neighbors, etc., while enthusiastically revealing information on themselves. The huge database on these half a billion members and non-members who are written about is too much power for any private entity. But what if it is part of or is accessed by the military, industrial, national security, state complex? We all know that he who pays the piper calls the tune. Therefore, whoever controls the purse strings controls the whole project. When it had less than a million or so participants, Facebook demonstrated the potential to do even more than IAO, TIA, and TIPS combined. Facebook really exploded after its second round of funding, $12.7 million from the venture capital firm Accel Partners. Its manager, James Breyer, was formerly chairman of the National Venture Capital Association and served on the board with Gilman Louie, CEO of InQtel, a venture capital front established by the CIA in 1999. InQtel is the same CIA outfit that funds Google and other technological powerhouses. One of its specialties is data mining technologies. Dr. Anita Jones, who joined the firm, also came from Gilman Louie and served on InQtel's board. She had been director of Defense Research and Engineering for the U.S. Department of Defense. This link goes full circle because she was also an advisor to the Secretary of Defense, overseeing DARPA, which is responsible for high-tech, high-end development. Furthermore, the CIA uses a Facebook group to recruit staff for its national clandestine service. Firing of CNN Sanchez, Token Latino Committed Ultimate Sin, by Henry Macau, Ph.D. Rick Sanchez, the reporter who was recently fired from CNN for saying Jews control the media, didn't understand his role. He was Latino window dressing. His job was to keep the left-right puppet show going, but he committed the cardinal sin by pointing to the Illuminati Jewish puppeteers. So, CNN canned him. He's sore for being treated like the token Latino, that CNN wouldn't take him seriously, and that the Jewish comedian John Leibowitz Stewart ridiculed his ambitions to be a serious commentator. On Pete Dominic's talk show, Sanchez scoffed at the notion that Jews today are persecuted. He implied that they control CNN and other news networks. Yeah, very powerless people, laughs. I'm telling you that everybody who runs CNN is a lot like Stewart, and a lot of people who run all the other networks are a lot like Stewart. And to imply that somehow they, the people in this country who are Jewish, are an oppressed minority? Notably, we're talking about Illuminati, i.e. Masonic Jews, the Murdochs, the Newhouses, the Ox-Sulzbergers, the Myers, elite Jews that secretly persecute other Jews and everyone else all across the planet. Anyway, Dominic pressed Sanchez to give examples that proved CNN or Stewart were prejudiced, just seconds after Sanchez had stated that his CNN boss had told him he was just a Latino who couldn't aspire beyond being a token reporter. His CNN boss, according to Sanchez, said, "You know what? I don't want you anchoring anymore. I really don't see you as an anchor. I see you as a reporter." Stewart is a border collie who keeps his liberal sheep penned. Bill O'Reilly and the Fox News crew do the same for conservative sheep. Stewart, entertaining as he is, lampoons anyone who doesn't fit in his liberal mold. Sanchez said that Stewart is against anybody who doesn't agree to his point of view, which is very much a white liberal establishment point of view. He can't relate to a guy whose dad worked all his life. He can't relate to somebody who grew up poor. While intelligence agencies partner with social media and government to keep tabs on the commoners, entrenched Illuminati bosses decide who in the conventional corporate media will present the news to the commoners and who will not. Page 6, Across the Nation with Mark Anderson. Fusion centers seen as hubs for major power abuse, by Mark Anderson. The relative independence of police agencies in America has been eroding for a long time. The friendly cop on his beat, whose job is to serve and protect the public, too often has been twisted into serving and protecting the almighty state and its well-connected corporate colleagues. When 9/11 happened and the Department of Homeland Security was created, even more federal dollars flowed like water to state and local police agencies, and consequently they became much more militarized in their attitude and operations. Fusion centers eventually entered the law enforcement landscape. Fusion centers collect and share information with local, state, and federal law enforcement, and increasingly with the military and the private sector. Although information sharing is legitimate and often necessary for law enforcement, the fusion centers are operating with little oversight at a time when new technology, government powers, and zeal in the war on terrorism are combining to threaten our privacy at an unprecedented level and turn America into a surveillance state, is how the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, sees the matter. But interestingly, concern about fusion centers can be found in left, right, and other publications, since no one wants to live in a real-life 1984. According to the ACLU and Patriot groups, these fusion centers, special data gathering and intelligence posts, need to be closely scrutinized and held accountable. There are about 50 fusion centers set up and operational in every state across the country except 8: Idaho, Nevada, Michigan, Nebraska, Arkansas, Mississippi, New Hampshire, and Alaska. The states that do not have them basically say under construction. California leads the way with 7 fusion outposts. The main anti-terrorism information center is in Sacramento. The Sacramento Center is staffed with FBI, state, and local analysts. Other centers are in San Francisco, Norwalk, San Diego, and Los Angeles, as well as a second Sacramento site. Not all fusion centers are exactly alike, and most Americans do not knock genuine law enforcement that is not politically motivated and would leave free speech and other freedoms alone. However, major concerns about fusion centers include the actual or potential involvement of the military in domestic policing at a time when Americans are experiencing the onslaught of an increasingly brazen centralized apparatus of law enforcement. Many of these fusion centers are in state capitals. One of the newer ones was built in Austin, Texas, which is the only one so far, at least officially, in that huge state. The local group, Texans for Accountable Government, TAG, in early 2010, told AFP about their opposition. They also brought their concerns before the Austin City Council, but the center's construction finished anyway. Missouri, whose fusion center is at 1510 East Elm Street in the capital, Jefferson City, became infamous in early 2009 for the now-withdrawn Missouri Information Analysis Center, MIAC, report that implied that supporters of Congressman Ron Paul, former Constitution Party presidential candidate Chuck Baldwin, and like-minded people were potential homegrown terrorists, even though they only criticized the nation's domestic and foreign policies and sought corrective action. Stern complaints from Paul, Baldwin, and others made the authorities back off on MIAC. But MIAC's mention of Paul and Baldwin was but part of its sketchy claims. While it broadly discussed various militias, abortion opponents, and other movements typically labeled right-wing, MIAC even claimed that those who oppose the NAFTA superhighway system, which includes the Trans-Texas Corridor, and point to the system's role in the documented proposal for a North American Union, are only engaging in another conspiracy theory, not fact. However, these real, publicly promoted super tollway plans connect Mexico, the U.S., and Canada in a corporatized tollway, railway, and utility grid, the very nations that would form the NAU. And it's not as if opponents of tollways cutting their ranch land in half are dangerous like, say, Mexican drug cartel operatives who endanger life and limb at the border and likely have operatives within the U.S. much of the time. But no sooner had MIAC been apparently canned when the U.S. Department of Homeland Security released another quite similar report, Right-Wing Extremism, Current Economic and Political Climate Fueling Resurgence in Radicalization and Recruitment, designed to paint concerned Americans with the same brush that would be used for describing real terrorists. It was shared with police agencies nationwide. A summary of the ACLU special report, What's Wrong with Fusion Centers, which was first published in 2007 and updated in 2008, notes the following with regards to crunching data gathered from various sources. There are serious questions about whether data fusion is an effective means of preventing terrorism in the first place, and whether funding the development of these centers is a wise investment of finite public safety resources. Yet, federal, state, and local governments are increasing their investment in fusion centers without properly assessing whether they serve a necessary purpose. Page 8, AFP's Spotlight on Congress. Bill H.R. 2378 would allow tariffs to be levied on Communist China. The House recently passed new legislation directed at China's policy of keeping its currency, the yuan, artificially low so that Chinese businesses can dump their products on the U.S. market and undercut American businesses. On September 29th, the Currency Reform for Fair Trade Act, H.R. 2378, passed a vote of 348-79. To populists and America firsters, the bill is great news, as it's a huge step in the right direction when it comes to bringing jobs back to Main Street America. The bill amends previous trade legislation, paving the way for U.S. officials to enact duties on a broad range of imports. Specifically, it authorizes U.S. trade authorities to study whether a trade partner intentionally undervalues its currency against the U.S. dollar. If U.S. officials determine that a foreign power is undercutting the United States, then they have the authority to thumb their nose at global trade groups and hit the offending country with tariffs in order to counteract the unfair trade practice. While the bill does not specifically reference China, it is clear the communist country is the main target. China's unfair trade practices' negative impact on the U.S. economy is undeniable, with an estimated 2.4 million American jobs being lost or displaced as a result of our massive trade deficit, said Representative Rosa DeLauro, Democrat, Connecticut, following passage of the bill. This legislation, the Currency Reform for Fair Trade Act, would give our government the ability to fight back against these unfair trade tactics, create up to 1 million domestic manufacturing jobs, and cut our deficit with China by an astonishing $100 billion a year. The new measure cites the Tariff Act of 1930, better known as the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act. That bill was signed into law on June 17, 1930, and handed officials the power to slap tariffs on more than 20,000 goods. Following on the heels of the stock market collapse in 1929, the bill was considered a great success by many populists at the time because it immediately helped farmers and American manufacturers who were competing against heavily subsidized foreign imports from Europe and Asia. It also had the benefit of raising considerable revenue for Washington at a time when taxes were falling due to the collapse of the economy. The tariffs were kept on thousands of foreign goods until internationalists pressed Congress just before the war in the mid-1930s to roll back duties on all imports. Since that time, globalists and free traders have argued that Smoot-Hawley shut down trade with the United States, exacerbated the Great Depression, and provoked numerous other countries to enact their own retaliatory measures. But objective studies have shown that Smoot-Hawley only raised tariffs to the level of most other countries, such as England and France. And while unemployment did go up considerably during the Depression, this was more due to huge increases in debt and Wall Street's gambling in the stock market than it was to taxes placed on foreign producers who were looking to do business in the United States. Creating jobs was exactly what legislators had in mind by reviving Smoot-Hawley. As Americans struggle to rebuild the country following the collapse brought about by Wall Street, this bill should see quick passage. It's a no-brainer, says Mrs. DeLauro. It will help support American businesses, workers, and consumers while creating high-skill, high-wage jobs of the future. But the problem remains that many senators are in the pocket of big business, which is heavily invested in China. As AFP goes to press, the Senate Finance Committee is debating the new bill. There is no word yet as to whether it will get the floor for a vote before the midterm elections. Free speech alert. Senators support censoring internet. Republicans and Democrats are great at wagging their fingers at foreign governments that oppress their own citizens. But top legislators are not without their own sins when it comes to undermining America's right to free speech and thought. Today, the internet is one of the best ways to get controversial ideas out to a wide audience without being filtered by the controlled press or court historians. The trouble is, the net is increasingly facing attacks from big business and government, which want to use copyright infringement as a vehicle to shut down websites. The latest assault comes from the Combating Online Infringement and Counterfeits Act, S-3804. Stopping the theft of copyrighted materials is certainly a good thing. The problem with this bill, say its critics, is that it is overly broad in its application. Should the bill become law, it would, for example, hand the U.S. Justice Department sweeping authority to shut down websites that use video or articles from the mainstream media to probe the September 11th attacks. Even worse, the Justice Department could bypass courts entirely and order internet companies to blacklist particular sites that are alleged to contain copyrighted materials. People would no longer be able to access these sites, because their service providers would simply block them from view. On one website that is bringing attention to the bill, Tim Berners-Lee, a British computer engineer credited with being one of the founders of the internet, responded to the congressional measure. Neither governments nor corporations should be allowed to use disconnection from the internet as a way of arbitrarily furthering their own aims. Should America shut down Arab websites? If some legislators in Congress have their way, the U.S. government will get expanded powers to silence Arab revolutionaries who have taken to the Internet to make their case and give their side of the story. In late September, congressmen on the House Subcommittee on Terrorism, Nonproliferation, and Trade looked at how the U.S. government can ramp up cyber warfare to muzzle Muslim and Arab groups in their struggle against the Israeli-U.S. juggernaut and its allies in the controlled media monopoly. Committee Chairman Representative Brad Sherman, Democrat, California, argued that censoring websites would be in the best interest of Americans because it would be done under the auspices of fighting terrorist propaganda. Groups like Hamas, the Taliban, and even Al-Qaeda maintain a considerable presence on the Internet, running websites in multiple languages, including English. Anyone around the world can access these sites and get the other side of the story, in contrast to what Israel and Washington claim. And it is this free speech that really irks people like Israeli mouthpiece Sherman. So far, Congress has been unable to roll back the laws that protect thoughts, but that could change in the coming years, say legal experts. As legislators become more and more brazen in their efforts to clamp down on any speech and thought that run counter to the prevailing powers. Page 9, AFP on Sovereignty. Pressure on Senators Can Stop Unbridled Treaty Power, by James P. Tucker, Jr. There are countless treaties or agreements that subvert U.S. sovereignty and shift it to the United Nations and other global bodies, while everyday Americans are kept ignorant of this essential fact. By calling what are actually treaties mere agreements, the White House can surrender U.S. sovereignty with a mere simple majority vote in Congress. Constitutionally, a treaty must be ratified by 3/4 of the Senate, obviously a much higher barrier than a simple majority. Both Republican and Democratic administrations have indulged in this simple majority deceit. Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution states that the President shall have power, by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, to make treaties, provided 2/3 of the Senators present concur. The U.S. Senate's website adds, the Constitution's framers gave the Senate a share of the treaty power in order to check presidential power, to give the President the benefit of the Senate's advice and counsel, and to safeguard the sovereignty of the states by giving each state an equal vote in the treaty-making process. President Clinton obtained a treacherous treaty he called an agreement with Mexico and Canada that became the despised North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, which opened the borders for illegal aliens to more easily enter America. As illegal aliens entered, manufacturing jobs left America in droves. By calling this obvious treaty an agreement, Clinton won congressional approval with a simple majority. The absurd genocide treaty was quietly ratified under President Ronald Reagan while America slept. George the Younger tried to win Law of the Sea Treaty, lost, ratification, which would give the United Nations control of U.S. coastal waters and inland waterways that spill into the oceans. When test votes showed it losing by wide margins, Bush, like President Bill Clinton before him, kept the treaty on his desk. It is heralded by the secretive Bilderberg Group. President Ronald Reagan had denounced Lost, pointing out that the United Nations could control the Great Lakes and the Mississippi River, which empties into the Atlantic Ocean. The treaty gives the UN power to regulate and settle disputes among member nations regarding the many resources and uses of the oceans, including navigational rights, territorial limits, and conservation and management of the marine environment. Despite America's refusal to sign on, the UN's International Criminal Court, ICC, wants jurisdiction over the U.S. The ICC makes it a crime to offend someone from a foreign country, so speak sweetly, in Spanish, to the illegal alien as he steals your car. By proclaiming its jurisdiction over all nations, whether or not they have signed on, the ICC, unless we stop it, is destined to become a world court under the UN, long a goal of Bilderberg. Bilderberg is also pushing for a direct global tax on all inhabitants as another giant step toward world government. The favorite option is a tax on oil at the wellhead, so you would pay a tax if you drive a car or heat your home with oil. 3 such proposals are pending before the UN General Assembly. 4 U.S. Supreme Court justices cited foreign laws and foreign court decisions in striking down a Texas law banning sodomy. Justices John Paul Stevens, Anthony Kennedy, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and Stephen Breyer Retired Justice David Souter also supported sodomy. They have been denounced by their colleagues, most forcefully by Justice Antonin Scalia, who was supported by Chief Justice John Roberts and Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito. Page 10. The War on Terror. FBI raids on U.S. dissidents are ominous harbingers of future, by Victor Thorne. In late September, a series of raids targeting peaceful anti-war activists occurred in Chicago and Minneapolis-St. Paul. In each incident, FBI agents, with guns drawn, broke down doors and confiscated computer hard drives, travel documents, phone records, anything they can grab that would provide information on who these people are and whom they were communicating with. During a September 30th interview, 91-year-old Polly Mann, founder of Women Against Military Madness, WAM, told this writer, "I knew all the people who were raided, and none were violent." One common theme tying these individuals together was their affiliation with three organizations: Colombian Rebels, the socialist-oriented Freedom Road, and a Palestinian Liberation Organization. Mrs. Mann addressed this latter group, "We've always spoken out for and felt solidarity with the rights of Palestinian people. Our literature also specifically cites Israel and how there isn't equality for the Palestinians." One of the women subpoenaed, Sarah Martin, tried visiting Palestine last year, but she was refused entrance by Israeli officials. When asked about the strong Jewish influence within President Obama's cabinet, Mann responded, "He's listening to them and not to us. There's no way these raids could have been carried out without knowledge at a federal level. We expected better from Obama." She continued this line of thought, "We in the peace community personally blame the president for allowing these raids to happen. Obama and the FBI are saying we can't communicate with people that they've deemed the enemy. They're denying us our rights of free speech and interaction." As to the specific purpose behind these sweeps, Mrs. Mann said clearly, "It's sheer intimidation. They want to shut us down. Uncle Sam isn't a benign old gentleman wearing a top hat. Instead, he's acting like a bully." Seconding many of her thoughts was the well-known Colleen Rowley, a 24-year FBI veteran and Time magazine's Person of the Year in 2002. Miss Rowley is known for having advance information about the 9/11 attacks that was not acted upon by the FBI when she was still working for the federal agency. During a September 30th interview with this writer, Miss Rowley described how she saw firsthand the conclusion of a search by the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force. Miss Rowley explained, "When they broke down Mick Kelly's door, the FBI used a knock-and-announce tactic, where they only have to wait 1 minute before executing their search warrant." She provided some other crucial insights. All the individuals raided had links to what are known as FTOs, or groups that the government deems foreign terrorist organizations. When you're on this list, there's no longer any judicial process under the Patriot Act. This shadowy legislative black hole circumvents a host of constitutional safeguards, which understandably rouses Miss Rowley's suspicions. There's no objective or outside input with these FTO lists, and the FBI doesn't need any factual justification to obtain search warrants, said Miss Rowley. Right now, there's a presumption of guilt before innocence, and it's definitely infringing on the civil liberties of advocacy groups. Without a mechanism to ensure culpability, Miss Rowley warns, the government has a green light to go after anti-war groups. Since the courts have been bypassed, there's no gauge to determine the FBI's accuracy when issuing these warrants. Another factor cannot be denied. If you read Dana Priest's recent three-part series in the Washington Post, Miss Rowley continued, it stated the U.S. now has 854,000 individuals with top security clearances. These people work for the FBI, DHS, CIA, state governments, in addition to private contractors. They're told, go find terrorists, and there are no ramifications if they falsely accuse someone. In regard to Obama's role, Miss Rowley told AFP, he initially tried to close Gitmo and release torture memos, but after being labeled weak, he's now almost worse than Bush. President Obama hasn't followed through on his promises. Miss Rowley concluded with this poignant message. We're at a critical juncture in America. The government is rounding up people again via their witch hunts and COINTELPRO, counterintelligence program, abuses. It's all rooted in presidential war powers that even trump the Constitution. Mark my words, this is a dire warning. If we don't stop them now, things are going to get far, far worse. Page 11. High-level crime and corruption. Vegas Court Absolves Trigger-Happy Cops of Murder by Pat Shannon. On a Saturday afternoon in July, Las Vegas Metropolitan Police shot and killed an innocent man who was shopping with his lady friend at a local store. Store security personnel considered him a threat after noticing he was carrying a concealed firearm. However, former West Point graduate Eric B. Scott, 38, was also carrying his concealed carry permit issued by the Metro Police, which in fact made it as legal for him to take his weapon into the store as any of the law officers. Police later claimed Scott threatened them with a weapon, but several witnesses said he was shot before having a chance to draw his weapon, if he even intended to do so. One of seven wounds was in the armpit, indicating that Scott's arm were raised when he was shot, as some witnesses claimed. Police never released the store surveillance video that would reveal the truth of the matter, and are now saying that cameras at the front entrance stopped working 2 days before the incident. The first officer to fire, some said without giving Scott time to react to his warning, was William Mosher, who was investigated but absolved in another fatal shooting incident in 2006. Records show that since 1976, there have been nearly 200 inquests into officer-involved shooting incidents there, with only one Metro officer being found at fault, and he was never prosecuted. Mosher and other officers testified that Scott pulled his weapon and aimed it at them, but did not attempt to explain how the weapon was in Scott's holster after the shooting. Cross-examination of witnesses was not allowed at the inquest. On September 23rd, the seven-person coroner's inquest jury deliberated only 90 minutes before finding Mosher and two other officers justified in the shooting. A Las Vegas reporter referred to it as police investigating police and reporting to the police. Eyewitness facts differ dramatically from the police reports. Attorney Ross Goodman said, "Scott did not pull a handgun. All the witnesses we've heard from have said he did not make any threatening gestures and didn't do anything that could be construed as acting in a threatening manner." Scott had an MBA from Duke University and was employed by Boston Scientific as a pacemaker sales representative. He, like many of the representatives from Boston Scientific, carried a concealed weapon for personal protection because they are required to enter dangerous areas of the city at all hours of the day and night in order to serve patients fitted with cardiac pacemakers and defibrillators. Piecing together witness testimony, Eric's brother William Scott said, "When Eric squatted on the floor to verify that three metal water bottles would fit into a soft-sided zip-up cooler, a Costco employee saw the weapon. Eric's shirt had lifted up, revealing a holstered pistol clipped to his belt on his right hip. A civil interchange ensued, and the employee informed Eric of Costco's policy that guns were not allowed inside company stores, although there are no signs to that effect posted outside or inside the facility. Eric calmly responded that his gun was legal and that he had a concealed carry weapons permit on his person. At a news conference following the inquest, father of the victim, Bill Scott, said that while Metro officers did the shooting, Costco killed Eric, referring to the overzealous reaction by security to alert police to a situation that was not threatening in the first place. He plans to file a federal lawsuit in an attempt to get the surveillance tapes and more of the truth. Reporter Bob Owens writes, "To hear the side of the story presented by Scott's family, friends, and some eyewitnesses, Eric Scott's death was the result of ignorance and embellishment on the part of the Costco staff and a combative, deterministic mindset from responding officers. This police attitude may have been provoked by security guard Shy Learley, who told the 9/11 dispatcher that Scott was behaving wildly and appeared to be on drugs. After police arrived en masse with a helicopter in the air, the store was emptied and Scott and his girlfriend exited the front door in front of three cops without incident before being confronted and shot in the chest by Mosher. He was shot in the back four more times after he was lying on the pavement. The cops then roughly handcuffed Scott and, in the words of an eyewitness, tossed him onto a gurney as if he were a sack of potatoes." Tennessee Courts Imprison Truth in Obama Eligibility Case by Pat Shannon. If it's not trigger-happy cops or door-kicking FBI men, it's corrupt courts that fail to restore and protect liberty. Remember retired Navy Lieutenant Commander Walter Fitzpatrick III? He got nowhere in a Knoxville, Tennessee federal court last year in his attempt to expose Barack Obama's alleged foreign birth. So he was forced to resort to his local grand jury. But he was thwarted again while discovering more corruption at the county level. For example, Gary Petway had been sitting as grand jury foreman, appointed by the court year after year for two decades in breach of Tennessee law. Then Fitzpatrick tried to take matters into his own hands by attempting to arrest Petway, but it was Fitzpatrick who went to jail for a few days while the good old boy system decided what to do with him. Meanwhile, friend Darren Huff of Georgia, while traveling to a Fitzpatrick court hearing in his pickup truck, proudly bearing an Oathkeeper sticker, was stopped and interrogated by area police outside of Madisonville, Tennessee. The stop concerned his weapons. When he showed his permit to legally carry them, he was finally released after 90 minutes without charges for the time being. 10 days later, Huff was federally charged with crossing a state line with intent to incite a riot and illegally trafficking in firearms. He later faced trumped-up charges in Monroe County, Tennessee. In that same county, Fitzpatrick must defend counts of 1. Participating in a riot, 2. Disrupting a meeting, 3. Causing an annoyance in a public place by an act that served no legitimate purpose, 4. Obstructing a law enforcement officer attempting to make an arrest, 5. Threatening to harm grand jury foreman Gary Petway by an unlawful act, and finally, 6. Intentionally coercing and intimidating Mr. Petway. "You can't make this stuff up," Fitzpatrick told AFP in exclusive on-the-scene coverage. Trial for both men has been set for December 1st. AFP has been following this situation for the past 18 months. Astoundingly, Judge John Kerry Blackwood, newly appointed when Judge Carol Ross had to step down after appearing as one of multiple defendants in Fitzpatrick's suit against the government, has a history of similar acts of grand jury control in a neighboring county. Fitzpatrick says that court records there show that Blackwood has broken the law by keeping the same grand jury foreman seated for 23 years. Stay tuned. Page 12, Inside the United Nations. UN deals with illegal aliens of a different sort, by Victor Thorne. If aliens from another star system were searching for intelligent life on our planet, they probably wouldn't start at the United Nations. Nonetheless, according to London's Sunday Times on September 26th, UN representatives from the Office for Outer Space Affairs were poised to appoint Malaysian astrophysicist Mazlan Othman as their ambassador to greet ET visitors. By all appearances, the Times insinuated that the UN was staking its claim and establishing protocols in preparation for some sort of global disclosure. They even provided the following quote from Ms. Othman to fellow scientists where she broached the subject of first contact with supposed alien beings. "We should have in place a coordinated response. The UN is a ready-made mechanism for such coordination." One is reminded of the classic sci-fi movie, The Day the Earth Stood Still, in which the UN was the conduit for meeting the ET visitor shown in the movie. Oddly enough, by September 28th, the UN denied all reports of Ms. Othman being its space ambassador. The Times, however, used Professor Richard Crowther, a UN delegate and member of the United Kingdom Space Agency, as one of its sources. Times reporters also obtained recordings of Ms. Othman's above-mentioned address to colleagues. The Times also interviewed astronomer Martin Dominic from St. Andrews University, who organized a Royal Society conference at which Ms. Othman will speak. He stated, "Any encounter with alien life would have major consequences, and scientists cannot take the political responsibility, so we need the UN to take the lead." Is the UN's dismissal of this story a case of damage control? It's a distinct possibility, since Ms. Othman isn't the only one considering contingency plans in regard to supposed alien contact. In Denver, Initiative 300, which would create an extraterrestrial affairs commission, gained enough support to be on the ballot for this November's midterm elections. On May 13, 2008, Reverend Jose Gabriel Fumes, director of the Vatican Observatory, discussed the prospect of intergalactic entities outside our solar system. "How can we rule out that life may have developed elsewhere? Why should we not talk about extraterrestrial brothers? It would still be part of creation." In his opinion, if aliens don't diminish or negate the existence of God, then Lord Martin Rees elevated this concept to another level. As president of the Royal Society and Queen Elizabeth's official astronomer, Rees' February 22nd remarks opened entirely new doors. "They, aliens, could be staring us in the face, and we just don't recognize them," said Rees. I suspect there could be life and intelligence out there in forms we can't conceive. Just as a chimpanzee can't understand quantum theory, it could be there are aspects of reality that are beyond the capacity of our brains. Governments say they have been taking an active role in engaging aliens since two Voyager spacecraft carried a message in 1977 from UN Secretary General Kurt Waldheim. In addition, the Air Force's Project Blue Book ran from 1952 to 1969 before being discontinued. Today, NASA's Kepler satellites and Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, SETI, radio telescopes continue to search the skies for possible alien communication transmissions that can be deciphered. Not everyone is convinced that any future interactions with an alien species, if such species exist and can somehow be contacted, will be benign. Earlier this year, astrophysicist Stephen Hawking proposed that extraterrestrial life is a near certainty. However, he warned, "I imagine they might exist in massive ships, having used up all the resources from their home planet. Such advanced aliens would perhaps become nomads, looking to conquer and colonize whatever planets they can reach." Echoing this cautionary stance are seven former Air Force officers who addressed Washington, D.C.'s National Press Club on September 28th. Their testimony revolved around a long history, dating back to 1948, of UFOs being suspended over our nation's nuclear missile sites and then deactivating their weapons systems. One of the speakers at this forum was Captain Robert Salas, who this writer interviewed on October 1st. Salas described a March 16, 1967 incident at Montana's Malmstrom Air Force Base, where a glowing red object hovered over the site and they disabled 10 Minuteman nuclear missiles. Although forced to sign a non-disclosure statement regarding this classified incident, Salas has now broken his silence. He told AFP in an exclusive interview, "With my background in the Air Force, as well as working for the Federal Aviation Administration, weapons maker Martin Marietta, and on the space shuttle, I can assure you this craft was not manufactured on the planet Earth." He continued, "What our government says about national security never being compromised at these nuclear bases is patently false and misleading. In light of this testimony, were UN delegates compelled to marginalize and make a mockery of the Sunday Times article in order to quell an array of uncomfortable questions? Or was this exercise simply another way of floating a story to gauge the public's reaction? Whatever the case, citizens should be aware of this compelling information because, as Franklin D. Roosevelt quipped, in politics, nothing happens by accident." Page 14, International News. U.S. attempts to contain Chinese Navy will fail and cost billions of dollars. By Richard Walker. In our topsy-turvy world, U.S. officials run to Beijing to beg the communist Chinese to underwrite U.S. deficit spending. Then, the U.S. federal government, already dangerously dependent on China, spends its borrowed money patrolling the seas as far away as Asia in a feeble attempt to counter Chinese expansionism. Apparently, Washington is worried that China's determination to dominate the seas surrounding it could produce the spark to ignite a naval war with American allies in Asia. Thus, the United States and Japan will launch a joint naval exercise in December on the Senkaku Islands in the East China Sea. The Japanese-controlled islands form part of the Nansei Island Range, also called the Ryukyus, stretching from Japan to Taiwan. The islands are strategically significant because of their proximity to Taiwan. There have been several incidents in which Chinese naval vessels expelled foreign shipping from sea lanes that China declared were in its exclusive economic zone. This year has seen intense U.S. naval activity in that part of the world. Since 2004, Japan has been rebuilding its naval capabilities to ensure it can defend the Nansei Island chain in the event of war with China. The chain includes the Okinawa Islands, as well as the Senkakus, and stretches for 650 miles, bordering the Southeast China Sea and the Pacific Ocean. It ends 75 miles off the coast of Taiwan. The Japanese Navy has spent several billion dollars developing highly mobile amphibious forces, with close air support linked to the major U.S. air communications hub in Okinawa. Japan sees China's massive naval expansion and aggression as part of a three-pronged strategy, beginning with efforts to assert control over the South and East China Seas, as well as the Yellow Sea and the Sea of Japan, to exploit the energy resources beneath them. By controlling the seas, China would be able to dominate the region and isolate Taiwan. The Pentagon got a taste of Chinese naval aggression in March 2009 when the ocean surveillance vessel USS Impeccable was forced by Chinese destroyers to leave an area of the South China Sea, which Beijing claimed as an exclusive economic zone. Naval strategists in India and Japan have told Washington they believe China intends to set up distant naval bases, much like the U.S. has done. For example, the Chinese have been courting Burma and Pakistan with the aim of using massive cash reserves and cleverly funded aid projects to persuade those nations to rent them deep harbor facilities. For more than a decade, the Chinese have been expanding their submarine fleet to keep an eye on U.S. aircraft carriers and destroyers in the region. One of the first signs China was aggressively tracking U.S. naval vessels in the South China Sea occurred on October 26, 2006, when a Chinese attack submarine shadowed the USS Kitty Hawk off Okinawa. Page 15, AFP on the welfare state. Politically incorrect board game available again for the bold, by Thomas Lewis McFadden. From 1965 to 1980, there was a constant dramatic increase in welfare payments in America. Millions and millions of people in the ghettos were convinced that it is a lot easier to produce many children and claim benefits than to build cars, grow food, or gain an education and earn an actual living. A new class of citizen was created with special rights, people who suddenly became far more equal among equals. So Robert Bowie Johnson, a Maryland resident and Vietnam veteran, decided to do something about this. He designed a board game, Public Assistance. Why bother working for a living? The game was an instant success and was carried by major retail stores like Toys R Us and Saks Fifth Avenue, even outselling Monopoly in some locations. In 1980, few people ever heard of the American Public Welfare Association, APWA, the nerve center of America's welfare empire. In 1987, the APWA changed its name to American Public Health Services Association, or APHSA. But we will refer to them as APWA. APWA's board of directors were mostly made up of self-appointed welfare commissioners from different state agencies, and they realized that their progressive empire was under attack by Mr. Johnson. First, APAW sent an action alert to the welfare CEOs of states, their term, and later to all 10,000 members of the organization. Executive Director Edward T. Weaver signed the letter which stated, "I agree with Secretary Harris, Jimmy Carter's HUD secretary, Patricia Roberts Harris, the NAACP, and the National Organization for Women, that the game is callous, racist, sexist, and a vicious brand of stereotyping. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People and the American Public Welfare Association, among others, complained that the game was a biased and offensive depiction of welfare recipients, and soon action followed. A vicious drive was cranked up to make sure the larger chain stores understood that it is in their best interest not to carry the game. Among others, Macy's canceled orders for the game it had placed in late 1980. The New York Times and others wrote mostly negative articles. Still, Mr. Johnson managed to sell over 10,000 games in the 1980 Christmas season. In 1981, Mr. Johnson started a litigation process against various organizations who were involved in organizing the boycott against him. The game sold 55,000 copies that year. Years later, the litigation reached the U.S. Supreme Court, but the judges refused to take the case. O Bozo, the Marxist clown, is the lead character of the game. It seems that Mr. Johnson, the creator of the game, had a vision of the future of America when he wrote the first sentence for the collection of rules for his game. What is this great welfare game? Public Assistance is a fun fantasy game based on the preposterous notion that a Marxist clown running on the vague and shaky promise of hope and change could become president of the United States. AFP sells the game for $29.50 plus $5 for shipping. A great gift for family entertainment this Christmas. The playing surface is spill-proof vinyl. It comes rolled up and lies perfectly flat. Nice color. A stack of over $500,000 in play money. We're talking serious welfare fraud here. A stack of 50 welfare benefit cards. A stack of 50 working person's burden cards. And 30 out-of-wedlock children. It'll take you less than a minute to cut out the kids. They're so cute. And that's all you have to cut out. The game is not available in retail stores. Page 17. Tough Talk from Jim Trafficant. Trafficant's Finest Hour, He Beats Fed Conspiracies, by Jim Trafficant. Recent national stories have highlighted U.S. attorneys and their abuse of power. The criticism is beginning to grow from all areas of America. The Department of Justice, DOJ, has countered that they've only had 201 identified cases of prosecutorial misconduct in the last 10 years. These bureaucrats in Washington, D.C., maintain that an average of 20 per year is an insignificant number when you consider the number of cases they handle. The DOJ claims to have prosecuted over 60,000 cases per year, arguing that in most cases, attorney error is most likely the culprit, not misconduct. Here are two cases to digest. Decide for yourself. The first is that of John Demjanjuk, the retired auto worker from Cleveland, Ohio, who the DOJ charged with mass murder, claiming he operated the gas chambers at the Treblinka concentration camp in Poland during World War II. DOJ prosecutors claim that Demjanjuk was, in fact, the infamous Ivan the Terrible. Demjanjuk's citizenship was stripped away. He was then extradited to Israel to stand trial for his crimes. Family came to me for help, reluctantly, knowing that I was not a DOJ favorite. They had been to every congressional office and every senator's office. Nobody would talk to them. The son, John Demjanjuk Jr., and son-in-law, Ed Nishnik, claimed to have favorable evidence that supported John Sr.'s innocence, so I investigated. An area newspaper wrote, "Trafficant supports Nazi mass murderer." Other politicians, at all levels, said I was crazy. Demjanjuk was tried, convicted, and sentenced to death. My investigation proved that Demjanjuk was innocent. To boot, I even proved the true identity of Ivan the Terrible, a man named Ivan Marchenko. So his first name was Ivan. Go figure. The DOJ denied my evidence. The Sixth Circuit Court refused my evidence. The evidence was delivered to the Israeli Supreme Court. After reviewing the evidence, the Israeli Supreme Court phoned me at my hotel in Jerusalem and said, "Demjanjuk will be delivered to you tomorrow night. Take him home." All my evidence came from the DOJ. They knew he wasn't Ivan, but they would have let him be executed. When we landed in America, the Sixth Circuit of Cincinnati, Ohio issued a statement. A tragic but honest mistake by the government. Tragic, yes. Honest, no. Office of Special Investigations prosecutors should have been prosecuted for their serious crimes. Subornation of perjury, obstruction of justice, violation of Demjanjuk's civil rights, conspiracy, and complicity in attempted murder. Ah, but Demjanjuk was just a Ukrainian guy from Cleveland. Well, when you violate the rights of one American, you endanger the rights of all. The second case I know in and out, because it was mine. The DOJ spent more than $15 million and assigned 250 agents to investigate me over 6 years. And our country was attacked, and more than 3,500 people were killed on September 11, 2001, during that time. At trial, the DOJ admitted they had no physical evidence. They even testified that they didn't even have a tape recording of my voice because they didn't tape it. If you believe that, you're either naive or uneducated. Former Secret Service agent Mike Robertson said, "The government made tapes. They probably had boxes of tapes. They said they had no tapes because they had no evidence of crimes by Trafficant. Trafficant could have used their own tapes to prove his innocence. Trafficant was railroaded." 7 witnesses said they bribed me. 2 men, Richard Dator and Namdi Okolo, stated the government pressured them to lie. 4 other witnesses testified that government witnesses confided in them that they lied to avoid prison. The judge made those 4 witnesses testify in open court, subject to perjury charges, but excused the jury and never let it hear their evidence. No one was charged with perjury. They could snatch me tomorrow and send me back to prison for saying this, but the judge and the government knowingly broke the law to convict me. One last thing. The former clerk for Chief Judge Lambros, attorney Percy Squires, testified that John Cafaro lied. The judge made his testimony look controversial. Now that Americans are recognizing the crimes committed by government attorneys, the DOJ is harping. Do I hear violins? Get back at me. Page 19. The Ryan Report from Vince Ryan. "Deflate Bloated Bureaucracies, Limit Big Government" by Vince Ryan. Many of you have driven by the Pentagon when visiting Washington. Some of you drive by it on your way to and from Washington without giving a second thought to that monstrous 5-sided structure that President Roosevelt ordered built. Completed on January 15, 1943, at a cost of roughly $83 million, the Pentagon provides office space for 26,000 employees and parking space for 8,770 vehicles in 16 parking lots. Many more arrive for work in carpools and on public transportation. On weekends, holidays, and evenings, however, most of the parking spaces are empty. Does that mean our nation is defenseless at those times? Not really. Ask anyone who knows about this situation, and they will tell you that most of the work is dealing with vendors, members of Congress, and performing other tasks that can only be done during business hours. Today, the word bloated is a favorite tag to put on the central government and its many agencies. The government is way too big, and the only way to make it smaller is to cut programs. But the question often asked is, just what would you cut out? No one can answer that because the task is insurmountable until the concept of limited government as envisioned by our founding fathers is understood and implemented. A book, Clichés of Socialism, published by the Foundation for Economic Education in 1962, explains the matter this way. Government should defend the lives and property of all citizens equally. This means protecting willing exchange and restraining unwilling exchange, suppressing and penalizing fraud, misrepresentation, predatory practices, invoking a common justice under written law, and keeping the records incidental to these functions. Government's legitimate purpose is to codify and then inhibit all destructive actions while leaving all creative and productive actions, including welfare, charity, security, and prosperity, to citizens acting voluntarily, privately, cooperatively, or competitively as they freely choose. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, BLS, in 2008, the federal government employed about 2 million civilian employees, excluding those in the Postal Service, making it by far the nation's single largest employer. About 85% of federal employees work outside the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. The sorry fact is that nobody cuts anything out of government. The employees, after a probationary period, have lifelong tenure. They can stay as long as they desire. Some of them are known to work into their very late years, health permitting. Recently, according to a Bloomberg report, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates said the Defense Department must be mindful of the difficult economic and fiscal situation facing our nation. And the department can't expect Congress to approve budget increases each year unless we are doing a good job. Indeed, everything possible to make every dollar count. Furthermore, Gates said the defense bureaucracy has swelled to cumbersome and top-heavy proportions. He also hopes to cut the department's health care costs. Consider the Transportation Security Administration, TSA. Representative John Mica, Republican Florida, wants the TSA reorganized. According to the website Logistics Today, a Government Accountability Office report stated that the TSA spends hundreds of millions of dollars annually on the spot, screening passengers by observation techniques program. TSA now has 3,000 behavior detection officers deployed over 100 airports. Yet, the program has failed to identify known terrorists that have traveled through spot airports. 17 known terrorists have traveled through 8 spot airports on 23 different occasions, including Faisal Shahzad, the accused Times Square bomber. Mica characterizes the TSA as a bureaucratic nightmare, with over 60,000 employees and top-heavy with supervisory and administrative staff. At TSA headquarters, which is 30% supervisors, the average salary is $106,000. Intelligence is another bloated area. According to Representative Ron Paul, Republican Texas, the Washington Post ran an extensive report on the bloated intelligence community where, as Paul noted, an estimated 854,000 people hold top secret security clearances. By my calculation, this is about 11,000 intelligence workers per Al-Qaeda member in Afghanistan. This also begs the question, if close to 1 million people are authorized to know top secrets, how closely guarded are these secrets? They also found that since the September 11th attacks, some 17 million square feet of building space have been built or are being built to accommodate the 250% expansion of intelligence organizations. Intelligence work is now done by some 1,271 government organizations and 1,931 private contracting companies in about 10,000 locations in the United States. This overall problem is basically the result of irresponsible politicians not living up to their oaths of office. Nobody in power seems to care, but they should. Perhaps that's why today there are so many angry and frustrated Americans who feel a pinch of what's happening but only resort to a quick fix at election time. While voting is important, understanding the concept of limited constitutional government takes time. But in the long run, it will prove to be rewarding to the people and put a real check on bloated government. Remembering Joe Sobran. Saying Goodbye to Gutsy Catholic Columnist Joe Sobran by Mark Anderson. Michael Joseph Sobran, one of the great conservative wordsmiths of this generation, passed away on September 30th at age 64 from complications stemming from diabetes at his home in Burke, Virginia, family members said. This writer met Sobran in April 2003 when he spoke at a Lansing, Michigan gathering. He made a memorable observation, pointing out that an Iraqi boy whose limbs were blown off in a vicious U.S. rocket attack was still clinging to life at the time, though every other family member had been killed. The boy's name, Joe said, was Ali. Then, Sobran pondering the terrible harm this boy suffered, pose this question. Was it really worth going after Saddam Hussein for this? Sobran, an Ypsilanti, Michigan native who was always strong in his Catholic principles, then noted that Christ said that harming the innocent like this is a direct affront to Christ himself, and no amount of political rhetoric or military grandstanding would ever change that. In other words, morality trumps the dead intellectual arguments among the neoconservatives whose idea of freedom is to tyrannize and terrorize people in distant lands with gun-barrel democracy. Sobran wrote about the grave immorality of abortion and touched on a number of other moral issues. He was also a staunch non-interventionist, and as such, his days as a top National Review writer eventually put him at odds with the magazine's founder, the late William F. Buckley Jr., a counterfeit conservative, or neocon, who had CIA ties. A major issue over the falling out between Sobran and Buckley was American support for Israel and its war machine. Sobran saw the folly and waste of such a policy, while Buckley was a partisan of the support Israel or else worldview that keeps America at war, or on hair trigger alert, at all times and drains its blood and treasure. So while much more could be said about Sobran, he had his heart and head in the right place. Therefore, it seems reasonable to assume he is headed to the right place after his life as the author of several books, and as a columnist, championing liberty with every word.